You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Up next is episode 2 in a special series by OPB's The Evergreen Podcast, created in collaboration with the Oregon Experience, the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA, and Jefferson Public Radio. Chelsea Rose is the director of SULA and the host of Underground History here on the Jefferson Exchange. This episode in the Evergreen series is titled Unearthing the Buried History of Women in Eastern Oregon's Lumber Mills. Chelsea has joined us in the studio to help us with a brief introduction. She'll also be around to help wrap up the story at the conclusion. Hi, Chelsea.
Hey, good to be here.
How would you describe this episode?
Well, I am very excited to bring the listeners with me, thanks to OPB's recording us out in the field. We get all the sounds. You don't get the heat or the mosquitoes, so I've saved you from that. But this is such a cool spot in really remote eastern Oregon that we've been working on, and I think it's just an exciting opportunity to share this research with everybody.
And what can people expect when they hear this?
Yeah, so you are going to learn along with us that we went out to this industrial logging, old logging town out deep in the forest, and what we found was not what we expected. We found evidence of women and children and families living on the edge of this big, you know, lumber operation.
Well, it's interesting that we didn't expect women and children.
That's right. I mean, you think about these kind of sites and you think about saws and lumberjacks and big, you know, cutting big trees and turning them into things, but you don't think about playtime or, you know, mealtime. And so it really is a way to kind of get into the personal and private lives of the men and women that were doing this important work.
Okay, well, let's take a listen.
Perhaps the most well-known representation of North American logging is a strapping, flannel-clad lumberjack with big boots and a bushy beard, double-bit axe in tow. He's a hero, a legend, larger than life. And I do mean large.
Oh, mighty Paul Bunyan, he lived long ago. His strength and his goodness helped America grow.
Yes, this tall guy may be a tall tale, but the mythical figure of the lumber industry came from oral storytelling traditions in real logging camps. He symbolized real American ideals, frontier spirit, work ethic, and rugged masculinity.
So when we think about the, you know, mills and the lumber industry is so traditionally associated with men. You think lumberjacks, I mean, it's a whole identity, flannel, all the things.
This is historical archaeologist Chelsea Rose. She's at the site of a former lumber mill in eastern Oregon's Blue Mountains.
But what we see archaeologically here is so much more for the women.
The history of the logging industry is full of tales of lumberjacks and lumber barons. And when you envision a lumber mill, maybe giant saws, hulking machinery, or even mill ponds come to mind.
Yeah, and this is the log pond where a lot of the materials like would have been kind of cached or stored, so this would have been filled with water.
And logs, yes, cut logs.
Yeah.
But when Rose and fellow archaeologists like Katie Withy went to explore the land where the Baker White Pine Mill existed for about a decade in the early 1900s, they were less interested in the industrial stuff. What they wanted to know more about was the daily human lives of the people who worked and lived there.
It is this little community that pops up in the middle of the forest.
And when they started digging into that, they found something interesting.
Lumber mills are also homes.
They are.
And guess who makes them that way?
People that live there.
The women.
The women.
From the Gert Boyle Studio at OPB, I'm Jen Chavez, and this is The Evergreen, a podcast from OPB about the place you call home. When you look beyond the conventional wisdom about the male-dominated lumber industry, you find the women and the families that made the company towns that grew around lumber mills home.
You know, when people think about the lumber industry in Oregon, nobody's talking about women.
And the wives of the workers who lived in Oregon mill towns like White Pine weren't just window dressing. they made important economic contributions to the extractive timber industry that once dominated the Pacific Northwest, contributions that have long gone unrecognized.
What archaeology has given us here that the historical record doesn't is the presence of women, and how loud they are in this archaeological signature is in direct contrast to how silent they are in the documentary record.
So today on the show, we're bringing you the next installment of our special series in collaboration with Oregon Experience, the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, and Jefferson Public Radio. Chelsea Rose joins us to talk all about unearthing Oregon history, the real stuff. As an Oregonian, an archaeologist, and the director of the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA, Rose's specialty is researching 19th and 20th century resettlement and development of the American West. She wants to know more about all the different people who helped build the Pacific Northwest. And one industry that played a supersized role in that was lumber.
The story of lumber extraction in this area in the early 20th century is also really tied into bigger extractive industries and the way that they impacted the landscapes that we have access to today.
In the 1800s, extraction of timber and other natural resources were barely regulated, allowing for exploitation, monopolization, and fraud. This spurred Congress to create protected forest reserves in 1891. In 1906, the Blue Mountain Forest Reserve was born. And 2 years later, part of it became the Malheur National Forest. And that is where the Baker White Pine Mill existed from 1910 to 1918.
A lot of these lumber operations are popping up during this era because railroads are being constructed everywhere.
Railroads allowed more access to remote forest land, full of pine trees that could be harvested and transported to the Columbia River and around the world.
But ironically, they also are creating a nearly insatiable need for timber to create the railroad ties, which had about a decade-long lifespan.
One of these railroads was the Sumter Valley Railroad, created to haul timber around using a system called milling in transit. Logs would show up at White Pine, get milled into rough-cut lumber, and then be transported to another Baker White Pine Lumber Company mill in Baker City for drying and finishing. White Pine was one of several mill towns that were connected by this rail line.
These little lumber operations at this time, these camps and little company towns, were kind of always understood to be short-term occupations. A lot of them, when they would move somewhere else, they would just pack up anything that was portable and go on to the next spot. And that's really what happened at White Pine.
The site that was once Baker White Pine Mill is now deep in the forest, only accessible by dusty dirt roads.
What was once a thriving community today is just, you know, forest lands. There's nothing that remains of that today.
Nothing except lots and lots of archaeological artifacts.
And I think that when we excavated here, we found like thousands of artifacts.
I mean, thousands. The artifact catalog's hefty.
There's just so much.
Archaeologists from SULA partnered with local archaeologists like Katie Withy to excavate the site in 2022. And yes, they discovered more than 8,000 artifacts, which the team has spent the past few years analyzing. Rose and Withy went back this past summer to visit. And the funny thing is,
we didn't come in thinking we were going to study the women.
No.
You may remember, if you heard our previous episode with Chelsea Rose about Chinese cowboys in eastern Oregon, that she's involved with the Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project. That group has been working to uplift the neglected histories of early Chinese Americans in eastern Oregon. And
we were interested in expanding our research to look at the Asian diaspora more broadly. Some of our colleagues out there knew that there were Japanese immigrant populations that were really involved in the early lumber industry.
Because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, rampant anti-Chinese sentiment, and other barriers in the late 19th century, industries that once relied heavily on Chinese workers began turning to other groups to fill labor needs. Japanese immigrants made their way to the Northwest working on railroads, like Sumter Valley. Some went on to work at mills. Census records and photos link Japanese American families to this area and the companies working here. But
we were really interested to try to find traces of those families at these sites, and we were not able to do that definitively. And what we found instead was a surprising amount of information just about the families and family life at this mill site. The role of women in particular became kind of the leading research thread that we pulled.
In their efforts to look beyond the work being done at the mill, already well represented in the historical record, toward the day-to-day lives of residents there, they focused on domestic spaces, including multiple house pads where homes once stood.
Let's try to find, there's a couple of houses over here I know we worked at.
Yeah, from what I remember, they
here's a stove.
Like flashing
for a stove pipe.
Yeah. See, I thought they were all kind of mid.
They did find things one might expect from a male-dominated industrial worksite, like clothing.
Evidence of more like men's workwear.
That's Rose's colleague, archaeologist Anna Sloan, back at the Sula Lab. She helped analyze and catalog the vast array of artifacts from the mill.
Suspender fasteners, belt buckles, even things like a heel plate for boots and a lot of...
To make them last longer, right.
Denim workwear buttons.
They also found a huge variety of tablewares, like dishes. And this was fancier stuff than what you'd see in bunkhouses or mess halls full of men.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things to me when I was working with this collection is the amount of porcelain vessels and the diversity of patterns. And this is the type of thing that you don't see in sort of what you would expect like a low-income household, right? And we've got just so many different floral transferware patterns here. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't expect to find that in the woods.
There were common items associated with household chores, like washboard fragments and safety pins, and food storage, like canning jars and earthenware crocks. These, alongside beauty products like face creams and jewelry, plus women's clothing items.
Things like corset stays, hosiery fasteners, decorative buttons.
That's right, woods be damned, women at the mill were dressing up.
Garter! That's what I meant. Like,
garter.
Garter clip. Ooh la la.
Oh, can't imagine wearing silk stockings right now.
No! Oh my God! These women are wearing like corsets and silk stockings out here. I can't even imagine.
There were items that suggested entertaining, like
what seemed to be teacups in this cloud and flying dragon pattern. These are porcelain, blue on white transferware made in Japan. So it's this really sort of fine Japanese porcelain. This was very trendy at the time that White Pine Mill was occupied.
Export wares geared toward American consumers, plus home decor items like curtain hangers and decorative glass.
So many cool things you can interpret from here too, like the glass lamp, lighting a home, but also like lighting the home to read or to entertain your friends or just all that life outside of the works. We obviously know there is industrial work happening here at the sawmill and the logging and everything, but just thinking about people's domestic lives and what that looked like after hours.
And you know, that lamp glass that we found, that chimney, was milk glass. So that's a choice, a decorative choice. It's a vibe. They're creating a vibe.
I have milk glass.
Yeah.
Women weren't the only family members of lumber workers at Baker White Pine Mill. Residents also included children.
Oh, Chelsea, look what I got for you.
Ooh, what'd you find?
A doll.
The doll face.
Oh my God.
Or a doll neck.
The team found doll parts, marbles, pieces of toys, and educational items.
A great little fragment of a children's, like an alphabet plate, with the nursery rhyme, "This is the maiden all forlorn." And again, we're seeing evidence of children and families here.
Children, I think, in this era are transitioning from little workers to, you know, being able to really have, you know, lives as kids. And you see that. They're kids out there. And this was probably a pretty fun place to grow up and just be able to run wild.
all these artifacts made it abundantly clear that life on the mill was a family affair. But why were women and children there exactly? Coming up after a break, we learn why the company's welcoming attitude might not have been purely altruistic.
You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. We'll be right back with the conclusion of Unearthing Oregon's History, a special series by OPB's The Evergreen Podcast in collaboration with JPR's Underground History. It was created in collaboration with the Oregon Experience, the Southern Oregon Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA, with director Chelsea Rose and Jefferson Public Radio. At the conclusion of this episode, we'll visit with Chelsea. Now let's get back to the story, unearthing the buried history of women in Eastern Oregon's lumber mills.
It seemed like everywhere they looked, Chelsea Rose and fellow archaeologists found evidence of the families who lived in the company town at the Baker White Pine Mill. This marked a change in the times.
The lumber company kind of model like this is changing from, or at least at this specific site, from a fully male-based workforce where they live in bunkhouses and somebody cooks and cleans for them and they just, you know, work, sleep, eat, and so forth, to one that has families there.
Sounds kind of nice, right? Like maybe the company was communicating to its workers, hey, we want you to be able to bring your wives and kids with you. Keep the family together. Build a life here while you work. How generous of them.
But then you start to realize, no, this allows them to get rid of an expense, which is to feed these workers and to do the laundry and to have that kind of staff in place, because now the wives will do it for free.
The artifacts related to household chores, washboards for laundry, safety pins for mending, cookware for making dinner, well, household is the key word there, as in, that's where all those chores are taking place now.
There's some number crunching going on, and they're like, if we have the wives doing the cooking, then we don't have to have the mess halls and we don't have to have the bunkhouses. These folks that are owning and operating these mills are now able to get a cost savings for the unpaid work of women.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the unrecognized labor.
Yeah, the unpaid and unacknowledged work of women.
I'm thinking even the census records, it says like keeping house, which that entails so much, yeah.
And that's not all. Where were all these household goods coming from? From a store, of course.
Now they can create a company store and they can charge the families for food and for supplies. And so they are able to not only economize, but also capitalize off their workers in new ways.
Because of the costs being shifted onto workers' families, archaeologists found evidence of economizing in the home. It's interesting to compare with artifacts they discovered near communal housing and mess halls, which did still exist for some men on the site.
Yes, we can kind of see some of these larger cans here, the more industrial size would have been utilized for feeding the camps, like more people, just larger quantities of food in general. Group meals, yeah.
There was pressure to have really good food and lots of it to not only recruit workers, but to keep them there because, you know, if they didn't like the food there, they could go to another operation down the road. So they were eating really well, and it probably was expensive.
But in smaller family households,
we're seeing more of a reliance on wild game. We're seeing more variety in the types of meals that are being cooked. There's evidence to suggest there's also some economizing going on, because instead of the worker, you know, there's one person to feed, now there's multiple, as you have women and children included in that same meal.
At the same time, though, artifacts like the imported Japanese porcelain tea sets and special dishes suggest women and families were having each other over.
To me, it feels almost like, you know, how were the ladies sort of signaling to each other about their family's social status? They probably did a lot of socializing, meals that would have called for specialized serving dishes.
These, along with decorative furnishings, jewelry, and beauty items, show women at the mill, as Rose sees it, performing middle-class domesticity and even aspiring class mobility in the unexpected context of this rugged landscape.
Because there's no reason, if you're living in the woods, to have all these different beautiful dishes and glasswares that aren't purely functional unless there's somebody's watching. So they are feeling visible in some ways and invisible in others.
Who knows? There might have even been a little drama.
I wonder if part of the way that they were buying these fancy dishes and the pressed glass and the way they're setting their table, how they're internalizing that, if they want to be taken more seriously. Like, we're not just the laundry women. We are the wives of these important people doing this work. Or if there's competition amongst the women of the camp, you know, it's hard to know the social dynamics. I'm sure they could come up with, like, the next Yellowstone could be like the lumber barons, you know, like I think there's like so much work to, I'm sure there's like the soap opera element to, you know, living in this space.
The Real Housewives of White Pine Mill, or As the Mill Wheel Turns, perhaps. But whatever the social dynamics were, this was all unfolding at a transitional time for women in society.
It's a really interesting era for American women, I think, because we're sort of at the end of the Victorian era and all of the things that sort of went along with that in terms of this middle class domesticity. But we're also on the eve of the 20s, right, where sort of the new woman, really different styles of clothing, this notion of sort of freedom for women.
Even as Rose and her colleagues' research, like good research often does, created more questions to study next, in the artifacts preserved at this old lumber town, so much is revealed about the nuance and texture of these women's lives that is not available in existing records.
We're lucky to have written records at our disposal to answer many of the questions that we have. However, archaeology and the artifacts that we find at these sites give us a totally different window. You see how they actually went about their day-to-day lives versus what's written down in records versus company records, which are also providing just this narrow window, and have often been what has been relied upon for interpretation of these types of industries.
Sula's Anna Sloan says there's something immutable about the archaeological record.
You know, it's solid, it's evidence that was directly left behind by people, and it's up to us to interpret it, but it tells a truth that's a very deep truth.
Archaeologist Katie Withy says she feels a connection to the people who lived at the Baker White Pine Mill. Her grandpa was a lumberjack, the union rep at a sawmill. And today, she's a woman working in rural spaces in science, another male-dominated profession.
You know, I identify with that idea of living in a space, operating in a space that's not necessarily focused or created for you or recognizes you at all times. So,
less washboards, but probably still a lot of laundry.
I don't identify with my washer and dryer. I'd rather with my tableware. But I mean, I have those things too. Like, that's the labor of a working
woman,
a wife,
today.
A mom. Yeah.
Yeah. So still a lot of women, even though now it's more mainstream for women to be, you know, in and acknowledged in the workforce, but that does not always alleviate the domestic chores and that side of it. So sometimes women have to navigate both.
Yes, yeah. And yeah, and it's cool to see that archaeologically and to have that connection, direct connection, really, to these like working mothers that we see here.
The work towards women's full rights and recognition at work and in society continues today. But in the meantime, the work of archaeologists like Sloan, Withy, and Chelsea Rose can help correct and supplement history for women in rural Oregon whose lives have been silenced in the documentary record.
And I think that that's one of the reasons we do archaeology,
yes.
is to like give voice to the voiceless and to like try to make space to show this invisible labor that was definitely exploited and capitalized off by the company town.
She says whether or not these women were willing participants does not really change their contributions to the male-dominated logging industry at this key moment in Oregon history.
There's work to be done for women to be recognized in these industries, because we're just talking about wives that were cleaning after loggers. I mean, there's women loggers. So I think that there's so much more to do to recognize the role of women and, you know, just to make sure they're counted along with the men.
To learn more about the Baker White Pine Mill and the women and families who made it home, check out Chelsea Rose's article and video collaboration with Christy Goshi for OPB's Oregon Experience. You can find it at opb.org, and we'll link to it in our show notes. And a special shout out to the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and to our partner station, Jefferson Public Radio, where Rose hosts the podcast Underground History. Check it out at ijpr.org. Stay tuned for more from Chelsea Rose about unearthing Oregon history in the weeks to come. Thank you for listening to The Evergreen, our podcast from OPB about the place you call home. I produced this episode, and our technical director is Stephen Cray. Layla Isbell mixed and mastered the episode. The OPB podcast team also includes Mia Estrada, Julie Sabatier, and Sage Van Wang. Chelsea Rose and Christy Goshi did the interviews you heard. You heard a clip at the top of today's episode from the 1960 Mellow Tunes cartoon Paul Bunyan, with music from the 1952 RCA Victor Bluebird Children's Records recording The Story of Paul Bunyan. Music in this episode comes from Audio Network. And if you have a question for us, please reach out. Email us at theevergreen@opb.org. I'm Jen Chavez. Catch you later.
Well, you didn't have the chance to get to the market, did you? And you didn't get to the washing, and you didn't get to the kids, and you didn't get to me.
You want cookies? You got cookies. You want laundry?
You've been listening to Unearthing the Buried History of Women in Eastern Oregon's Lumber Mills, and that was quite an eye-opener. Chelsea, women play pivotal roles in Eastern Oregon's lumber industry. Why is that surprising?
Well, I think a lot of times we discount domestic labor as real labor because it's happening all the time. But in this instance, being able to outsource the very real and expensive tasks of cooking and feeding and doing laundry for all these men working in the lumber industry was a cost savings for this particular lumber company. And that was unpaid, unacknowledged labor on behalf of the wives and the women that lived in this community. So being able to see that archaeologically was really an important opportunity to expand our understanding of the way that this industry was supported and maintained over time. It's also a really cool opportunity to see that even though these women have been invisible in history as these you know, the role they played, they were very visible in their community at the time. And we know that because we found jewelry and corsets and all these like kind of performative outfits and tablewares that show that, you know, there was some showing off happening in this, you know, this forested community over time, which is also really fun to see. So people are, there's social lives happening in addition to, you know, the not so exciting stuff like doing laundry.
Yeah. Chelsea, this was a collaborative work, right?
Yeah, it's an exciting opportunity to pair archaeology that we're out there doing with podcasting. We made little mini documentaries. And then, you know, by using the resources of Oregon Public Broadcasting, Jefferson Public Radio, we're really able to get this information out to the public.
Well, the work you're doing to dig up missing pieces of the puzzle suggests that we haven't been getting the whole story for generations. Now, this is just one of so many puzzle pieces missing from the textbooks that we use to teach Oregon students. So how do we change the narratives at the earliest stages to ensure that future generations of Oregon students have a more holistic understanding of the historical record?
Well, I think there's two parts to that question. Number one, looking at kids in the archaeological record and recognizing playtime is important to reflect, you know, so kids can see that their history, you know, people, there were kids in Oregon since the beginning of time. And so it's fun to recognize that phase of life and to kind of see what life was like from their perspective. But to get more to your question, we are collaborating across the board with as many folks as we can to do just that, to make sure that the stuff we're finding out, this important information that's really shifting the way we think about Oregon history, isn't just siloed in archaeological literature. And so to do that, we do a lot of public talks, we do podcasts and videos, you know, like this one. And then we also collaborate with the Oregon Historical Society. They have a bunch of different educational resources that help us get this information into the hands of teachers so people can really get a more nuanced and more accurate view of Oregon history.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thanks for the work that you do, Chelsea.
Thank you so much. Great to be here, Mike.
And thanks again to OPB's Evergreen Podcast, The Oregon Experience, and Sula for this episode of Unearthing Oregon History. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.